In 2004, award-winning journalist Patrice Gaines teamed up with her good friend Gail Dry Burton to open the Brown Angel Center. Together, they run monthly workshops for imprisoned women in Charlotte, North Carolina. Their next workshop will be February 17th. The two help inspire women to reflect on their past decisions and find the tools to move forward. Patrice Gaines is former reporter for The Washington Post and the author of Laughing in the Dark and Moments of Grace, Meeting the Challenge to Change. Michael Eric Dyson caught up with Ms. Gaines earlier this week.
Ms. Gaines, welcome to the Michael Eric Dyson Show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we launch into deeper issues, let's begin with your own personal story, which is rather compelling. Take us back to the summer of 1970, please.
Sure. I was a 21-year-old heroin user. I was the mother of a 2-year-old. And I went to a concert, a Steppenwolf concert in Charlotte, North Carolina, with my daughter's father and another young man. And at that concert, we got busted. And I had all of the drugs and got charged with possession of heroin with intent to distribute and possession of a needle and syringe, which are felonies. I was fortunate that we didn't have the mandatory sentencing we have today. So I was able to plead guilty, and I was sentenced to a 5-year probation. However, of course, it was, you know, it changed my life drastically. It forced me to take a look at myself, and yet I really didn't have the tools to do that. I was so caught up in self-hatred that I just felt worthless, and this kind of, for me, just affirmed that, you know, I was indeed worthless. No one in my family had ever been to jail, and so I was filled with shame and guilt, and left the jail that summer and started, you know, trying on my own to change my life, and found it very difficult in this society that kind of requires that you just do it, you know, and be different. So I found that I couldn't find jobs if I put on my application that I had a criminal record. That was very difficult. And again, you know, just made me feel even more ashamed of who I was. Eventually, I applied for a job at a mental health center in Charlotte, North Carolina. And a woman there, an older woman, just saw that I had written down the truth and told me that she thought she could get me a job if I erased that information off my application. So I gladly did. She hired me. And after that, I never put the information on my application again. I ended up learning that writing just kind of saved me. You know, it made me feel better about myself, that I felt like I could put my burdens on the paper and I didn't have to carry them. So I started writing on my own and eventually applied for a program that was then called the Summer Program for Minority Journalists. I got accepted, went out to the University of California, Berkeley, to study, and then became a reporter, eventually ending up at the Washington Post, where I worked, you know, for 16 years and did at some point have to confront my past because they did find out about it. And when they did, they had to have some meetings to decide whether or not to employ me. And so I had to take a good look at, you know, who I really am and find a definition of myself that no job could define or no one else had control over. So I very much understand the journey of women that I see every month when I go into the jail.
Well, we jump a few years ahead. You've already taken us from the path of heroin to be heralded as a writer for the Washington Post. But in terms of your own empathy with these women that you've just discussed, how did that play a role in the sorts of stories about what you wrote, and how did it affect or shape your journalistic career in terms of when you wrote about people who had been victimized by either themselves in terms of bad behavior or bad choices or a dominant society that may have presented them with fewer choices than others? How did it impact and shape how you write and how you think about these issues?
Boy, good question. You know, what I ended up finding is that it gave me an amount of empathy that a good number of people who were working with me at the Post at that time did not have. I remember covering a murder trial, and I was covering it with a young white reporter, and at the time I was, I think, maybe in my early 30s. And I remember she looked at me and asked me, Patrice, why do people do drugs? I thought, you know, first, it's such a naive question, and I thought it's also a very difficult one to answer. And I also thought, why is she covering a story that has to do with, you know, people, young people, a number of whom, most of whom did do drugs, if she didn't have any understanding? But I thought, okay, she's asking the question, and so she's trying to understand. And I tried as best I could to tell her, but letting her know there's not just a rational, quick reason. So I think for me, I walked into stories understanding that there are complexities to life, and that the person I see before me isn't necessarily the person that they could be or the person that they will even be, you know, 10 years from now. So I think in addition to empathy, it gave me as much as possible the ability to not judge harshly or judge, sometimes not judge at all, which allows people to open up to you, you know, in ways they won't open up when they're met with judgment. And so it also shaped, I tried to choose stories of people who were facing these seemingly incredible odds and challenges, and yet were able to survive and even to succeed quite often.
You made an interesting statement earlier. You said, thank God there weren't mandatory minimums around. And when you, met your day with fate, so to speak, and turned your life around. But many people do face mandatory minimums. And it seems that there are far fewer Patricia Gaineses possible in a system that stigmatizes people, tracks them, and indeed consigns them to incarceration without the benefit of, you know, a second or that fourth chance that might be the one to turn them around, especially when they've committed nonviolent drug offenses. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, right. You are absolutely right. I think that people, and when I say people, I mean those of us who are not, as I say, behind the wall incarcerated, have to understand the impact of laws that are so harsh that just have a one fix for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's like as if we prescribe the same drug to everybody with, you know, all kinds of different ailments. So we have, when I go into the prison, just for instance, you know, we have about 250,000 women, say, incarcerated, which impacts about 1.3 million children in this country. And some of these women, we've separated them from their children, so we're causing even more harm. And maybe they are incarcerated for writing bad checks or for prostitution or for drug possession or for crimes that we could handle in a much better way, not only for these women, their children, but for ourselves, for our community. It doesn't make us safer to incarcerate them. So then the question becomes, how can we do it more cheaply, more efficiently, really change their lives, impact the lives of their children positively so that their future changes also, and still keep us safe? And there's so many ways that that can be done.
We're speaking with award-winning journalist and author Patrice Gaines about her inspiring life story and her workshops for women currently incarcerated in Charlotte, North Carolina. Tell us about your workshops. What are some specific tools you teach women to help them reflect on their past decisions and to help them move forward?
Well, one of the things I know, you know, from my own personal experience is that you experience great shame and guilt. People, you know, don't understand or believe that somebody, say, who commits a crime, you know, is really filled with shame and guilt. But I can tell you that more likely they are. And so we deal with that, you know, with changing their image of themselves also, with not carrying that shame and guilt. I always say that shame and guilt has a reason that it exists to set some boundaries on behavior. I teach that you need to take responsibility for your actions, but that you cannot heal from what made you make the decision to commit the crime unless you let go of that shame and guilt. And so we do exercises teaching them to look at the decisions that they made and see a reason why they made them. You know, in my own case, I was fortunate that I could afford and had the education enough to get therapy. And through therapy, found out that my relationship with my dad, my perception of how my dad felt about me, really colored the decisions that I made. And so when I was able to change that perception, you know, and learn to let go of that, then I can make better decisions. And so it's a matter of giving them some tools that will allow them to do some of those things, and to even make a suggestion also to go to a mental health center, you know, when you get out, to get some affordable mental health care. There's a very simple exercise that I always close a workshop with, where the women divide into two groups. One group sits down in chairs in a circle, and the other group stands behind them. There's a woman behind each woman who's sitting. And the women standing think of a positive affirmation to speak to each woman, the same affirmation they whisper in each woman's ear. So if there are, say, 20 women standing, then if you're sitting down, you get to hear 20 good things about yourself, you know, such as even you are created in the image of God, you know, you are capable of all things, whatever. People weep because they have never heard a positive word in their lives. No one ever said you are beautiful. No one ever said you are smart. You know, no one ever said you're capable beyond your greatest imagination or anything like that. And so we're talking about, you know, just what we do in our system is simply lock away people who really need healing. And then we say, you're free. Now go and change your life. And we don't give them a job, don't help them. And so, you know, just sometimes there are simple exercises. So then we talk about the effect of what you say, what you speak to other people, what you have heard in your life, how you change that recording you hear in your head.
Sure. You also talk to them about the importance of changing the way they view money. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, yeah, you know, we don't talk about stocks and bonds and investments. We talk about how the decisions that you make about money are related to how you feel about yourself. For instance, how if you are filled with guilt and you're a mom, you may go out and buy your 7-year-old kid a pair of $150 Jordans. And somebody will look at you and you know, turn their nose up and say, well, she's on getting welfare and she's out there buying these shoes. Well, you know, we look at how you're trying to make up or something that you can't really make up for in that way. And it's just the relationship between what you think of yourself and every decision you make, including how you spend your money.
Mm. And how you spend your money, of course, relates to self-definition and priorities in life. And, you know, that's a more gentle way of encouraging even people with limited resources to think critically about their relationship to their money. But let's be real. People with far more resources have a greater margin of error and make a whole lot more mistakes than people with far less money. I mean, think about Hurricane Katrina, when people were lambasted for spending $2,000 on what was considered to be inessential items, or, you know, just going out and blowing it, when people got $1 million, you know, bonuses on the state dole, so to speak, after notorious AIG was bailed out by the government. So it is an interesting contradistinction there, and a contrast between, you know, ourselves, our identities, and our monies for people who have a lot more and people who don't have much at all.
Well, you know, and we always talk about, too, about how the system doesn't have to be fair for you to be successful in it, and that how you can't focus on quite often, you know, the unfairness of it. Sure. There are plenty of things in life that aren't fair. And so, yeah, I try to show them that we, even within this, there are decisions you can make, you know.
You prevent them from just the sort of analysis I just made.
Absolutely. That's right.
Yeah, that's very helpful. That's very helpful. Keep them away from Dyson. That helps on a lot of levels. Talk to us about the healing power of forgiveness and how to learn to love yourself and others. It sounds simple. Some people might think it sounds like the abuse excuse, as one author said, and some people might think it's a bunch of therapeutic compensatory sap. But obviously, it's central to self-definition and how you operate in the world.
Well, yeah, and you know, forgiveness. My goodness, it's an old word because it can be a very difficult thing to do, and because it's a process, it can be a lifelong process. And when I walk into the jail, the women that greet me there are quite often women who have some things to forgive that some of us will never have to deal with in our lives. You know. We're talking about being abused as a child, being raped, all kinds of, you know, just atrocities. And but what I always say is that forgiveness is forgiving you a new life. And so we talk about the myths of forgiveness, that forgiveness means you're letting someone off the hook. When actually you are on the hook with them as long as you are obsessed with this in your head. So we talk about, you know, what you can better do with your energy and your mind than to process over and over and over something that is gone in the past. But, you know, how, and as I said, I totally recommend highly therapy. Also to these women, recognizing that an all-day workshop is not going to heal them, but is hopefully going to introduce some of them to some new thinking and, you know, to ignite a starting process. And so we just talk about letting go of some of those burdens, and some of those burdens are, you know, going over and over things that happened to us in our childhood, as opposed to acknowledging they happen, looking at the pain it caused and how that pain is affecting the decisions you make every day, and just working from that point.
We've been speaking with Patrice Gaines. She's a former reporter for The Washington Post and the author of Laughing in the Dark and Moments of Grace, Meeting the Challenge to Change. Ms. Gaines is the co-founder of the Brown Angel Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Many thanks to her for joining us on the Michael Eric Dyson Show today.
That's it for the show today. I'm Troy Johnson, sitting in for Dr. Dyson. The Michael Eric Dyson Show is produced and distributed at WEAA-FM on the campus of Morgan State University.